You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up, the presidential debate season launches tonight. We'll look at what candidates need to do to come out on top, and we'll ask for your thoughts.
First, the state budget process continues with the Senate narrowly passing the bill today. Soon, that spending package will move to the governor's desk.
It will be Governor Tony Evers' first chance to use his veto power on the state spending plan, a veto power that is considered one of the strongest in the nation.
Our partners at WisConText recently took a closer look at what's called the governor's partial veto powers in Wisconsin, and Will Cushman joins us now to talk about it. Will, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, break this down for us. What makes the governor's veto power so strong here in Wisconsin?
Well, most states have partial veto powers, also known as line item vetoes. What makes Wisconsin's unique is really the language in the constitutional amendment from 1930 that approved those partial vetoes, and kind of the vagueness of that language. It says that, actually, let me just read it here. The ballot question in 1930 the voters were asked, shall the constitutional amendment proposed by Joint Resolution No. 43 of 1929 be ratified so as to authorize the governor to approve appropriation bills in part and to veto them in part? The operative term there being in part. It's been a pretty contentious term over the years, in particular because of its vagueness.
Sure. And line item differs from the partial veto here because, correct me if I'm wrong, small things can be changed as part of the partial veto. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's not only just one whole item in a budget. It's as little as a sentence or a word or even in some cases a character or an individual numerical digit.
Okay, and that can actually be a pretty big difference between one fewer zero and one extra zero if that was how the governor decided to put in their veto.
Right, exactly. So for the first like four decades after this constitutional amendment in 1930 was passed, governors exercised their partial veto powers pretty conservatively. That changed in the 1970s with Governor Lucey, and the first instance of kind of a really selective use of this partial veto was when he changed an appropriation from $25 million to $5 million by striking just that digit two.
And do we know what the context was for that decision back in the day? Not to put you on the spot, a history lesson.
I think I have a screenshot of it right here. It was transportation funding.
Gotcha. So this feels like a pretty powerful thing in the governor's arsenal, but what are the limits to the partial veto?
Right. There are some limits. Those have been set out by a couple further constitutional amendments, one from the early 90s and one from 2008. Which sought to limit this partial veto power because it had been used in ways that were so creative that a lot of people questioned whether or not they should have been used that way. Governor Tommy Thompson was particularly into the partial veto powers. The constitutional amendment from the 1990s that restricted this made it so that you couldn't create new sentences from other sentences. So you couldn't delete parts of sentences to form new sentences. And then in 2008, the amendment made it so that you couldn't create new words from partial words, from striking out parts of words and then kind of smushing them together to create a new word.
It's interesting to kind of see this in practice, as we just heard with your throwback to Governor Lucey in the 70s. We are talking to Will Cushman right now. He's an associate editor at WisConText, and he's with us to talk about the governor's partial veto power here in Wisconsin. So let's take a look back, because part of the reason why this story is a little bit surprising is that the argument for this originally came from the state Senate, in that someone in the legislature, totally different branch of the government. Was it strange that a member of one branch wanted to give potentially more power to another?
Yeah, you know, I thought that was kind of weird too. So, yeah, this originated with Senator William Titus. He was a progressive from Fond du Lac, and he proposed this in the 1927 session of the legislature, which was the first time it was passed. A constitutional amendment has to be passed by two consecutive legislatures and then ratified by voters. So the first time it passed was in 27, second time in 29, and then ratified by voters in 1930. It's kind of unclear. I mean, it's totally unclear to me why William Titus wanted this particular provision himself, especially since he was a member of the legislature, as you said, and this constitutional amendment was strengthening the governor's power in relation to the legislature. I can say that there was general concern growing after 1911 is when the legislature started bundling budget bills into omnibus bills, so putting multiple provisions into one bill. And the concern was that with multiple budget items included in one bill, and a governor if a governor didn't have the ability to veto just parts of that bill, then a governor would have to basically sign the legislation in full or veto it in full, rather than being able to pick the parts of the budget bill that they wanted to approve or veto.
I mean, and it sounds like why many governors have a version of this power, given that every other state more or less has the line item, which feels a little bit more straightforward versus our partial veto. You know, you just mentioned that this had to be approved basically twice in 27, 29, and then ultimately ratified. You know, besides the growing concern, was there broad support at the time, I guess?
Yeah, it seems that there was. The amendment was ratified in a vote of about 2-1 statewide. So nearly 65% of voters voted to ratify this amendment. And it did seem to have pretty wide political support. As I mentioned, State Senator William Titus from Fond du Lac, the one who introduced this amendment, he was a progressive, but the state senator who was like the chief proponent of this of the amendment in terms of public support when it was up for ratification was a socialist state senator from Milwaukee, and it had support from Republicans as well.
So we've had the history lesson, but now let's look more recently, literally within the last 6 months. How has the partial veto fight basically played out recently?
You know, it's interesting. I'm not really sure. Robin Voss, Assembly Speaker, said that the Assembly was working on a way to form the current budget package in a way that would kind of galvanize it against this partial veto power. I'm not exactly sure how that's going to work. I know that the governor's partial veto powers were not affected by the lame duck bills that were passed in December.
So we've talked about the legislative and the executive branch. Now look at the judicial. How has the state Supreme Court dealt with partial veto through the years?
Yeah, there have been disputes over use of this partial veto power over the decades, beginning in the 1930s, not long after the amendment was passed. In fact, 8 cases reached the Supreme Court. 6 of those cases resulted in an expansion of the power. And sometimes the Supreme Court had to consider, like, literally the definition of the word part. So there's an opinion from the 1990s in which the Supreme Court discusses the Webster's definition of the word part in order to basically say that the way that Governor Thompson vetoed a portion of a budget was, in fact, correct because he reduced a number.
Interesting. Yeah. And so in, you know, following this story, what stood out to you the most as we wrap up?
What stood out to me the most was how governors had this partial veto power that was super expansive, beginning in 1930, and really no governor used it in a really creative way for 40 years.
Oh, wow.
And then with Governor Lucey, that kind of really took off, and it really took off in the 80s and 90s. With Governor Tony Earle and then Tommy Thompson. And so to me, that says something about maybe the increasing gamemanship in politics in the latter part of the 20th century and the early 21st century, and just like an increase in partisanship and polarization that I think we are all quite familiar with.
With that in mind, is the partial veto here to stay?
It appears to be, at least for now.
All right. Will, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Will Cushman, associate editor of WisConText. He joined us today to talk about the governor's partial veto power in Wisconsin. And you can read his piece on the issue, The Story of Wisconsin's Singular Partial Veto, at wisconText.org.
Coming up, a destructive type of invasive worm arrived in Wisconsin 6 years ago. We'll find out about a new treatment that might help to limit their spread. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up, we'll hear about a promising approach to controlling an invasive worm here in Wisconsin.
But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about biking.
Wisconsin is far from flat. Just ask anyone who bikes. Steve Gotcher tells us about one notorious stretch of road near Trempealeau in southwest Wisconsin.
The morning was already hot and humid as my friend Steve and I pedaled out of Perot State Park. The mercury had already passed 80, on its way into the 90s. But my thoughts were focused on one thing. What do they mean by Hip Breaker Hill? On my biking cue sheet, it's singled out with an exclamation point. When a hill is named, that usually means it's long and it's steep. The area east of the Mississippi River near Trempealeau is filled with long, winding valleys, connected by short, steep passes. Narrow paved roads hug the valley edge and then snake along through the hills to the next valley. We roll by chicken farms with long, low, windowless coops. In between, fields of corn and soybeans dot the landscape. Our path takes us into the village of Dodge, past some sheds, a church, and a couple of taverns. Before we can blink, we're headed out of town on the smooth, rolling asphalt of County G. Turning off G and onto Pine Creek Ridge Road, we spin ever closer to Hip Breaker. A passing pedestrian looks at me and nods. Or was that a smirk and a shake of his head? As I contemplate this, a couple on a motorcycle roll by in the opposite direction. I can't quite hear as I spin past, but I would swear the driver and passenger are laughing at those crazy guys trying to bicycle to the top of that hill. With these thoughts swirling, I roll along the valley floor to the foot of Hip Breaker. As usual, my friend surges past me and disappears. The road curves slightly and gently slopes upward into the woods that form a natural canopy overhead. I look down. Spray painted on the road is 12%. Is that the pitch of the hill or the percentage of it I'd ridden? The road levels, and I look down on the roof of the barn I'd just passed. So far, this climb isn't so bad. Then another number, 16%. The trees seem to lean in closer, and the odd pine branches hang like jagged teeth over my head as I shift to the lowest gear. The road disappears into the trees. I creep slowly, knowing that 16% is indeed the pitch. The breeze dies, and the stillness causes the temperature to soar, making breathing nearly impossible. Don't stop. Don't stop. Pounds in my head as I start to switch back across the width of the road. Another corner, and the hill only ascends further into the trees. I stop. Gasping for breath, I know I need to regroup. But clipping into my pedals again without falling over on a 16% grade isn't easy. I manage to clip in and slowly zigzag up and up. The hill feels endless. Finally, I see the growing horizon. In a few minutes, I'd be there. But that short distance might as well have been the width of the Grand Canyon. As I approach the crest, two guys with red faces wearing camouflage hats on ATVs shout over the roar of the engines, "You could have used one of these!"
That wouldn't have been as much fun, I guess.
At the top, I savor my conquest. My lungs burn and my legs ache, but my hips are fine. Maybe they should have named that hill Lung Scorcher instead. The next 6 miles gently slope along, back to the flats leading to Trempolo, where a cold pint of microbrew awaits my full attention.
Steve Gotcher is a technical director and producer at Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every single Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find out more about Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now a new invasive species appeared in Wisconsin 6 years ago in the University of Wisconsin Arboretum in Madison.
They're called Asian jumping worms, and for gardeners and others, they're becoming a big problem. If you're not familiar with them and you've got a strong stomach, we've tweeted out a video of what they look like over on Twitter.
Usually worms in a garden are a pretty good sign and do important work in soil health, but it's a different story with these invaders. Fortunately, our next guest is here to talk about a possible solution.
Brad Herrick is the ecologist and research program manager at the UW Arboretum. Brad, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So why are these Asian jumping worms so destructive?
Well, we don't know all the possible reasons why, but right now what we've seen in forests and in gardens, that they seem to change the soil structure. So they create this kind of coffee ground-like soil structure. And unlike other earthworms, they only live in the top centimeter soil right underneath the leaf litter. And so all their consumption of the organic matter is happening in the same area. So it really turns that soil over quickly, creates a loose, porous soil that can be difficult for plants to germinate in. Difficult for other soil organisms to live in. We know that they can have negative impacts on salamanders, millipedes, some other soil biota. And, you know, and we're learning more and more about these since they're relatively new to Wisconsin, especially. So research is just starting to come out. So we're learning more about them.
These were discovered in the Arboretum in 2013. What impact have they had basically since you all found them?
So we've been tracking their spread over the last 6 years or so. That soil change I mentioned has been ubiquitous wherever we found them. Also, they disperse or outcompete every other species of earthworm. So wherever we've found these new invaders, we don't find any other earthworm species. Now, one thing that I want to mention is that there actually are no native earthworms to Wisconsin. All earthworm species are non-native, and many are invasive. So most of them are from Europe. So like the common nightcrawler is one that everyone knows that's used for fishing a lot. But that's actually not a native earthworm. So since the last glaciation, we think that if there were native earthworms, they were extirpated, otherwise killed off. And so our native habitats, forests, savannas, did not evolve in the presence of earthworms. So they don't need them to be a healthy system. Gardens, though, like you mentioned earlier, can benefit from earthworms. But these earthworms don't do the same kind of thing that other European species do, so they're not beneficial in that respect.
So it sounds like there's some incentive to get rid of them, which with in any invasive species is easier said than done. And that's where this research that you're working on comes in, and it involves heat. Tell us about what you found.
Right. So in Wisconsin and in many states, commercial compost industries are regulated. And so to make compost at the commercial scale, they have to heat up their piles to 131 degrees Fahrenheit for 3 or 15 days, depending on the type of pile. So we sort of thought of, and the reason why they do that is to kill harmful bacteria, pathogens, fungi. And so we thought, well, could this possibly be a way that we could control these earthworms, specifically their cocoon? So these earthworms are annual species, and so they overwinter with these little 2-millimeter cocoons that are probably what's being spread since they're so hard to see. And there's no way that we could control them. So we thought, well, maybe heat would do the trick. And so we subjected cocoons to different temperatures below the 131 degrees Fahrenheit and above. And we found that at 104 degrees, no cocoons were viable. So we dissected the cocoons and looked inside, and there was no living organism. And so it was a fairly black and white finding in terms of there was nothing that lived over 104 degrees Fahrenheit. And so one of the options is that if you have compost that's commercially produced, in theory, it'll reach that temperature. And the cocoon, the compost at that step should be earthworm and cocoon free.
So you're talking about the fact that you can, at least on a small scale, do this. The Arboretum, if we're using that as an example, is a pretty sizable tract of land. How does this inform larger scale mitigation here?
Right. That's a great question. That's sort of like the next step that we need to look at is scaling up to make it applicable to, not even large gardeners, but, you know, lands like the Arboretum, 1,200 acres. And at this point, it's probably not applicable in terms of a mechanism to control earthworms. But at a smaller scale, something like solarization, so using black plastic or clear plastic, might heat the soil to a high enough temperature where you can kill cocoons. Right now at the Arboretum, what we're focused on still is minimizing the spread. And so, and this is what we tell master gardeners, master naturalists, and homeowners, is that there are sort of what we call best management practices that you can do, and that's basically kind of know what your yard or your environment is and notice changes in that and make sure that your tools and equipment are clean before and after you leave an area. Don't trade plants with your friends, or at least know that your plant material, your soil is free of these earthworms. So there's still work to be done in terms of how to scale this up, this treatment up to control.
And briefly, is there a chance that, this just gets completely eradicated in Wisconsin, or is it too soon to say at this point?
Yeah, I don't think complete eradication is the goal, frankly. And it's like with many invasive species like buckthorn and garlic mustard, it's sort of a control it where you can invest resources. Earthworms, as you can imagine, they're everywhere, and you don't see them often, and they're easily spread. And so I think it's keeping them out of places where they're not in, especially the high-quality forests, your backyard garden, so following these best management practices. But where you can, and you can invest the resources, this heat treatment, at least buying products that have used this heat treatment on the compost, is a good way to go.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Brad.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Brad Herrick is the ecologist and research program manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum. There's more Central Time just ahead. Stay with us.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up tomorrow after 6:15 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin teacher recently came out to students as transgender through a video presentation allowed by school officials. Kate Archer-Kent talks with them about their experience and looks at student-teacher relationships and how they've evolved over the decades. That's tomorrow morning at 6:15 on The Morning Show.
Now, the first round of Democratic debates in the lead-up to the 2020 presidential election will take place over the next 2 nights. 20 of the now 25 declared candidates qualified to take part in the debates. 10 will be on stage each night, including Senators Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker this evening. Senator Bernie Sanders and former Vice President Joe Biden will speak tomorrow.
There's still plenty of time until Democratic voters officially get to vote for their favorite, and some voters have even already made up their minds. Today, we have unlimited access to information and candidates through social media and the 24-hour news cycle.
Given that, voters have access to a lot of information already about the candidates. Do the debates still matter? And what does a successful debate look like? We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Let us know if you're planning to watch and what you're hoping to hear from the candidates. Again, that number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Mike Wagner is a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So it's been a while since we've had one of these debates. So remind us of what the structure is going to be like for this debate tonight.
Well, I don't really think that we know what the structure will be like tonight with 10 candidates on the stage. And will people abide by the rules? I think we learned in the 2016 debates when Donald Trump and then eventually some other candidates started not listening to the rules and just talking when they felt like it, that if moderators won't rein people in, the structure starts to lose any kind of coherence. And so I'm not exactly expecting a breakdown of that tonight, but you know, you have a couple of hours, you have some opening statements, you have moderators switching in and out, and so each candidate probably gets, best case scenario, 6 to 7 minutes to talk to the voters. And so it's going to be a lot of information coming at voters quickly from people that most voters are not terribly familiar with.
We're not terribly familiar with a lot of these people. At the same time, you know, we're in an era where social media is everywhere. We have a 24-hour news cycle. If we really want information about these candidates, we can pretty much find it at our leisure. So with that in mind, do these debates still really have the same importance that maybe they once did?
Well, you know, in some ways, I would say that this is more important because there are so many people running, and most voters are not familiar with most of them. And so, yes, I could Google the candidates running for the president and maybe learn a little bit about them, but I probably would need to know who they are first. And I think if we were walking down State Street in Madison and said, can you name the 20 people who are going to be on the stage? Most people, I bet, would get 7 to 10, maybe, but to get all the way to 20, I don't know. And so I think even in a fractured media environment and in a fractured communication ecology that we have now, this is a focusing event. Lots of people are going to be watching the same thing, which happens way less than it used to. And so in that respect, I think the debate is maybe more important because there are so many people running. Undecided is a super popular candidate right now. And so this is a chance for voters to learn about who should I take seriously in the coming weeks and months.
So each candidate, as you said, will have, you know, maybe 6 to 7 minutes of speaking time total this evening. Who are they going to be talking to? Is it going to be the undecided voters, supporters, Democrats, undecided people with money? Who's the audience for this debate?
Yes. I think it's a great question, right? I think it kind of depends on who you are, right? So Joe Biden wants to do no harm. He wants to remain the front runner. And so he probably needs to prepare for a few probably genteel attacks from some of the candidates who might look to make a name for themselves. Same with Senator Sanders as one of the front runners as well. So they might be talking to their supporters to try to hold the line. Other folks, I think maybe 7 of the candidates are polling above 1% on average. So the other 13 are talking to everybody. Please learn who I am. Please remember something about me that you like to help as the campaign goes forward. And then I think those folks, the Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, maybe Beto O'Rourke, maybe Julian Castro, maybe Senator Gillibrand, those folks are all people that we thought would be in that top tier, and they kind of are moving around a little bit as the polling is pretty volatile right now. And so I think they want to become a viable second choice to Biden or Sanders, and I think they want to see if they can get themselves into double digits in terms of how they might look in polling that comes after the debate.
We're talking right now with Mike Wagner. He's professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison, and we're talking about the first of two Democratic debates taking place tonight. And you can join in with your questions or comments at 800-642-1234. And Mike, I'm thinking about something that our guest Ginger Gibson said earlier in the show when she was saying that she thought that candidates might be taking some extra shots at each other tonight because it'll give them more airtime. And, you know, we said we don't really quite know the rules yet. We're not really sure what's going to happen. But do you expect to see some candidates take some shots at each other because they think, hey, maybe I can get a couple extra minutes of time to really talk more about what I want to talk about?
You know, that's interesting because it could backfire in a couple of ways. If they're the only person taking shots, then they might come off looking too aggressive, too mean. Right now on the campaign trail, most candidates are not attacking each other for the most part. There have been a few exceptions here and there, but mostly it's been to draw out a policy distinction, not to be an outright attack. And so if only one person is doing it, I think that probably would be reported upon in the aftermath as a negative as compared to a positive. If several people are being negative toward one person, so presumably Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders probably as the people who are currently leading in the polls, then the story might be how those people reacted to that. And often what happens in debates is if I, as a candidate, mention your name, then you get to respond. And so candidates might hold their fire because they don't want to give the front runner extra time to talk.
Sure, and I would imagine they're also a little worried about maybe rankling the DNC or the people with the money who might say, oh, that person, they're a troublemaker. We don't want them as a candidate. Is there anything to that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think the DNC really is wary of the perception that their thumb was on the scale for Hillary Clinton in 2016. And so as one reason we have two debates, randomly selected 20 people on the stage, it's pretty easy to meet the requirements to get on the stage. The DNC is doing all that it can publicly to not look like they're trying to favor any particular candidate. And so I think that they would be loath to be viewed as supporting someone or not, or punishing someone or not for being negative. I think they do not want what happened at the Democratic convention in 2016, where there were lots of complaints about how the DNC seemed to favor Hillary Clinton. In terms of the debate scheduling, first of all, the number of debates last time and other factors that influenced who the nominee became.
So when 10 Democrats take the stage tonight and another 10 take the stage tomorrow, are we going to hear more about like in-depth discussions of Democratic policies, or are we going to hear more about, hey, I'm the man or woman who's best set to beat President Trump in a general election?
I think we'll hear a little bit of both, and depending upon who the candidate is. I think, you know, folks like Elizabeth Warren lead with policy. Others like Pete Buttigieg lead with biography. And so we'll hear from some candidates, here are the things I have done that make me qualified to be president. So we'll hear from others, here are my great ideas. From others, we'll hear, I'm the electable one. I think those are the three kind of major arguments that we'll hear in one form or another from different people over the course of the two nights.
We have a Facebook comment from Michael who says, I'm planning on watching both of the debates. There are five candidates I'm interested in hearing. I'm looking for demeanor and possible platform ideas. And I'm interested in that word demeanor. Are we looking for someone up there who looks presidential?
Well, the current president has violated a host of norms about what it means to be presidential. And I think the Democrats are nearly unanimous in their rejection of President Trump when you look at public opinion polls of presidential approval. And so demeanor, tone, the way they comport themselves when it's their turn and when it's not their turn, I think will all be things that some voters are watching. And those who are particularly rankled that President Trump beat Hillary Clinton in 2016 might be more affected by that sort of thing than they might have if someone else was the president right now.
And I'm also wondering, too, for all the Democratic candidates that are up there, do they risk of, say, do they have to balance that need to really put stuff out there versus something that could potentially be held against them by a general election opponent later down the line? How do they navigate that?
Well, they navigate it in a few ways, right? So if you're somebody who's polling at 1% and you take a shot at one of the top five or six candidates, that shot could end up in commercials against your team's person, you know, in the general election. So candidates need to be worried about attacking, and they also need to, of course, think and worry about gaffes. But those things happen in debates, and there's not a lot of evidence that they are hugely influential in affecting people's attitudes.
We're talking right now about the upcoming Democratic debates with Mike Wagner. He's a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you watched debates in the past? Do you plan to watch them in the run-up to 2020? How much does a candidate's debate performance influence your vote? Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a moment here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. We're continuing our conversation about whether debates still matter and what to watch for tonight and tomorrow as the Democratic presidential hopefuls take to the debate stage.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. We want to know what you think about the presidential debates. Is there a candidate you are really interested to hear from? What questions do you want the candidates to answer? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 888-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR.
And Mike, we talked a little bit earlier about the moderators. There's going to be five moderators over the next two nights, and they're going to be swapping in and out. And if there's one group of people I do not envy out there right now, it's the moderators, because they have a tough task at hand, and it feels like regardless of what they do, they will get criticism somehow from somewhere. So what advice do you have for the good folks, our friends at NBC, to help make this debate as good as they possibly can in terms of moderation?
I would focus on making the candidates, to the degree that they can, talk about what they would do if they were president. That's what's relevant. So say something nice about your opponent, are the kinds of things that we might like as humans but are not relevant to the job of being president of the United States. And so I hope that they stay on decisions and processes of decision making and policy goals and strategies to get those policy goals implemented. I hope they focus on those things when they're asking questions during the debates.
We have a Facebook comment from Joan who says she will be watching, and she says, considering the time limits, I hope they address what they think our most pressing problem is and how they would solve it. Mike, is that a good question for the candidates tonight? What is the most pressing problem that they see it and how they would solve it?
You know, in a 10-person per night environment, that's not a bad question. The downside, I guess, is that it allows each candidate just to kind of go into their stump speech and talk about what they want to talk about. But of course, candidates can do that anyway. In a debate, they can choose to answer the question they wish they were asked as compared to the question that they were asked. And asking them even to go into their stump speech isn't necessarily terrible either, because most of us are just being introduced to these people. And so hearing what they think is their best argument is a reasonable way to start to get to know these folks.
So we've got 10 candidates tonight, and I won't make you name every single one of them. But out of the 10, who needs to have the best debate performance tonight, in your opinion?
So tonight you have a few people who are looking to show that the early buzz should continue and in fact maybe shift into a little bit of overdrive. Cory Booker, Julian Castro, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke, those are all folks who we might have thought would be doing a little better than they actually are doing. And Elizabeth Warren is kind of the top tier candidate in this debate. The others are all going the next night. And so Warren, I think, wants to come out of this. She maybe has the most to lose, and that other group has the most to gain. The others are going to be fighting for attention and that hope that they can get themselves out of the less than 1% range.
And let's talk about tomorrow's debate as well, again, featuring former Vice President Joe Biden. It will be featuring Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. I'm assuming both of them need to have really strong debate performances to kind of continue polling where they are right now, which is pretty high up.
Well, I think right now they're high up because they're the two that everybody's heard of. And so that name recognition matters a lot in the very early days of presidential campaigns. You think back to 2004, and you know, Dick Gephardt and Howard Dean had been all over the news, and you know, they were the top two candidates, you know, coming into Iowa, and they were both out of the race, you know, a month later. And so the front runners are the ones who are known, and it's folks like Kamala Harris and Kirsten Gillibrand and Pete Buttigieg and John Hickenlooper. These are all folks who are would be more traditionally thought of as a credible threat to become the party's nominee, and they're looking to break out and be in that first tier that get mentioned with Biden, Sanders, and Warren.
We're talking right now with Mike Wagner. He's a professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. And we are talking about the first two Democratic debates, presidential debates, taking place tonight and tomorrow. And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Will you be watching? What questions do you want the candidates to answer? And what will help you pick a candidate if you're a Democratic voter or an undecided? What will help you decide which candidate you want to vote for? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, and we have a caller on the line right now, Arthur, who is in central Wisconsin. Hi, Arthur.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. What did you want to say?
Oh, thank you so much. What the contest will be both tonight and tomorrow night is to decide which of the 24 candidates, or 20 that qualified, are going to be the furthest out on the left of the perspective of the Progressive Party. They're going to compete doggedly to find out who can out-progress the other. And the problem with Joe Biden is He really doesn't have to do anything. He just has to hold on to his central status, because the fact of the matter is that the Democratic Party has moved very, very, very far to the left of where most Democrats, most Americans are. And Joe Biden holding that unbreakable percentage is because he's sitting much closer to the center when he says things like, these are my opponents, they're not my enemies.
Arthur, thank you so much for the call. And Mike, is this going to be a competition tonight to see which Democrat can out-progressive the others?
Traditionally, in party primaries, since you can't use party as a cue to know who you want to vote for, that is the kind of thing that can happen. Conservatives tend to run to the right. Democrats tend to run to the left to get more attention, especially as compared to front runners in those races. But in terms of American public opinion, the measure of national mood, which was developed by a scholar named Jim Stimson at University of North Carolina, has found that actually the public mood is more Democratic than it's been since he's measured it, I think, over the last 50 or 60 years. So it's an opportunity to move the party to the left for those candidates who would prefer that to happen. And more Americans are open to policies further to the left than maybe they were 4 and 8 and 10 years ago.
Do you think that it's important for a candidate, or do you think the media is going to be really searching for a winner, essentially, after tonight's debates?
Typically, news media tend to want to crown a winner, and there are a lot of flash polls with dubious kind of data gathering strategies that take place after these to try to declare a winner. And the research is not so much that what did the watchers of the debate think. The research suggests that when the news media say this person won and talk about that for days and show clips of that person for a few days, that can influence a lot more people, because the people who didn't watch the debate will see who won on the news and might start to affect their attitudes. And in a field of 20, that could be a big deal.
We've got another call now from Carolyn, who is in Door County. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi.
Go ahead with your comments.
Oh, my comment is, I'm hoping that the candidates will address what their plans are for taking climate action. I know that the Democratic Party is barring any of the candidates from having a standalone climate debate, which I think is just terrible. But I do hope that the candidates themselves mention or promote what they plan to do. The next president is going to have to deal with the accelerating effects of climate breakdown, and I think this is one of the most important issues for them to talk about.
Carolyn, thank you so much for the call. Mike, is climate change one of the most important issues for Democrats to be talking about right now?
I think so, and I think, you know, one reason we're not going to see a climate change debate is that the DNC does not want to be seen as favoring a candidate. And Washington Governor Jay Inslee has said, I am the climate candidate. And so if the DNC said, yes, we'll pick that issue to be one that's really important, you could argue that they're doing that to favor Inslee, who's not polling terribly well. And so are they trying to help him would be a narrative that might begin, despite the importance of that issue for the planet and more politically, just in terms of the politics of the Democratic primary. It's a big deal. We'll hear a lot about it over the next two nights for sure.
So, Mike, as we begin to wrap up, what are you going to be watching for in your role as a political scientist? What are you going to be watching for tonight during this debate?
Well, one thing that often happens in the few weeks aftermath of major focusing events in primary campaigns, whether they're elections or debates, are a winnowing process. And so eventually some of these candidates are going to go away. And when they do, what happens to the state of the race? Or if five or six folks start to realize it's not going to be them, where do their numbers of supporters go? Do they gather up and bring somebody from 1% to 5%? Are they evenly dispersed across the field and don't really matter much? So that's one thing. Another is who is crowned as the victor on each night, and how that might affect their strategies attacking the front runners going forward.
Do you expect anyone to drop out after these first two debates if they have a bad performance?
I don't know. It's possible. It happens after these things. It happened on the Republican side 4 years ago, or a couple of years ago. And so it wouldn't be surprising to see people drop out if they don't get a ton of attention and can't get any traction afterwards with their donors, with elites who might have been thinking about endorsing them and then backing away. Those are also signals that candidates are in trouble.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Mike Mike Wagner is a professor in the School of Journalism and Communication, Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He joined us to look at the first of the Democratic debates leading up to 2020 and how much weight these debates carry in our news-saturated environment. And just to note, for those who want to watch or hear the debate tonight, WPR does not have the rights to carry it, but it will be televised live on NBC, MSNBC, and Telemundo, and it can also be streamed for free on NBC.com.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk to an author who says cultivating your attention is like working a muscle. You need to exercise it to strengthen it. He'll help us whip our brains into shape.
Wisconsin farms have had a tough year so far, but the dairy breakfast must go on. We'll find out how farmers are keeping this tradition alive. That and more on Central Time.